So, I remember I walked in the morning and I was meeting Vanessa for the first time. We were all going on, rounds with, the whole big team. And I will never forget, seeing her in the bed in the ICU. And there was the simultaneous sort of interest, both from a medical standpoint, because here was this medical mystery coming in, but here was this very young woman coming in with this seemingly, out of the blue, crazy illness. And so I was very much drawn from both the sort of interest in helping to try to figure out what was going on. But gosh, wow, this woman's not a whole heck of a lot older than I am. How can I be there to be of comfort to her as much as she's able to, and then especially, Dale, her husband, and later on her other family members. And I think, over that time we had about 2.5, 3 weeks of working together. It was that part of that was the longevity of the sort of our longevity, I guess. And most people wouldn't think that 3 weeks is a long time, but I guess in the ICU or the hospital, that is sort of eons of time for us. We got to build that relationship. But for me, what it was is when I would go into that room, it wouldn't be, I'm going in there as your medical student or doctor. I'm going in there as an individual trying to help you. And in any way, shape, or form that I could. And, I wasn't some world-renowned neurologist who was going to crack the case on what was going on. I could do what I could as a medical student, but I gave what I had to offer. And that was largely my compassion and my care.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Missing Link for SLPs podcast. I'm Maddie, your host, speaker, and very passionate speech-language pathology advocate. You are listening to the Speechless SLP series with Vanessa Abraham, and you get a unique perspective in each one of these episodes on her journey being the speechless SLP in the ICU bed, unable to talk. So welcome to this series of the Missing Link for SLPs podcast. Glad you are here. Sit back, take a listen. So our two guests of honors today are Dr. Jared Rosen and our speechless SLP, Vanessa Abraham. And I want to tell you a little bit about them both before this conversation unravels too far, because their credentials are important and their story is even better. But let me tell you about Dr. Rosen first. Dr. Jared Rosen was born in Chicago and raised in the San Francisco Bay Area, the oldest of three kids. He earned his undergraduate degree in molecular and cell biology from the University of California, Berkeley. And after graduating, he conducted translational research in male fertility at the University of California, San Francisco. He went on to earn his medical degree from the University of California, San Diego, where he is currently completing his residency in internal medicine. And this is also where he met Vanessa. As a medical student and resident at UCSD, Jared's interest in ICU medicine and pulmonology flourished in both the hospital and the lab. Now in the final weeks of residency, he is thrilled to be heading to his fourth UC this summer to complete a fellowship in pulmonary and critical care medicine at the University of California, Davis. In his free time, he loves cycling and hopelessly trying to keep indoor succulents alive. And that is Dr. Rosen. You just heard him speak. So our second guest of honor today is Vanessa Abraham, our speechless SLP. She is a wife, mother, and school-based speech-language pathologist. She learned firsthand what it's like to be on the receiving end of speech therapy services after experiencing a sudden-onset critical illness that left her with limb and neck paralysis, as well as a PEG tube and a tracheostomy. She was thrown into rehabilitation world after being an independent and healthy and vibrant young mother. She went through swallowing studies, voice therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, the whole gamut. She had to learn to eat, talk, and move again. And her goal now is to help critically ill patients cope with a grief experience after a critical illness through speaking up about the topic of post-intensive care syndrome, depression, and anxiety in post-ICU. In addition, she strives to educate families and patients about the various rehab modalities that were successful for her. Welcome to this episode of the Missing Link for SLPs podcast. We continue on with our speechless series with Vanessa Abraham, and our special guest today is Dr. Jared Rosen. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Maddie, and thank you to you, Dr. Rosen, for being with me today. I'm going to cry, but you were there by my side during a very scary period of my life. And here you are 3 years later, still by my side and supporting my recovery in other ways. I remember in ICU telling you I would write a book. And I never imagined we'd be doing podcasts together. But a weird, twisted way, this is now a dream come true for me to have you here. And I can't thank you enough for this. This shows what an incredible, caring, and dedicated doctor you are. So thank you. Thank you both.
It's truly an honor and a pleasure to be here and to be able to talk to you, you know, these years later and to see the amazing progress that you've made, you know, both spiritually, emotionally, and physically.
Thank you.
We're going to talk a little bit today on your role about that. And when I first jumped on, I said, Dr. Rosen, and you're like, ah, call me Jared. And I love it when you pull it down at the very beginning to this basic level. Can you give us a brief introduction of why you became a doctor and why you want to do what you want to do?
Sure. Yeah. You know, and it's funny because I remember, you know, many years ago when I was first applying to medical school and you have to write your personal statement and everyone has this sort of same trite sort of general idea of I want to help people. And it's, you know, everyone tells you, you know, you can't write about that. You have to write about something else because everyone writes about that. But for me, it was very challenging because that was truly at the core of why I wanted to, you know, go into medicine is I wanted to help people. I loved sort of puzzles and mysteries. And so getting to combine that with the humanistic side of this is I can actually try to help somebody by, you know, solving some puzzle or helping to figure things out and then help guide people through just as a human, not as a doctor, but just as another human with them. That combination together was what really got me, you know, excited, interested in pursuing medicine.
I can see that. It's one of my favorite things about working in the medical field as well. Mm-hmm. The challenges, and I love how you bring in the extra layer of working with the human side of things. Mm-hmm. Vanessa, when we were prepping for this podcast, mentioned how she was, well, I can let you talk about it, Vanessa, how you were laying in the bed and how when Jared walked in, how he was immediately able to build that trust. Tell me about that.
Gosh, you know, from the minute I met him, and I've told him this, I had this love-hate relationship with him. You know, his body language, his demeanor towards me, he was always so kind. I think one of the things that really stood out for me, and I said this in a previous podcast, is that he treated my family too, and that gave me a sense of relief. I knew that he wasn't only there for me, but he was there for my husband. He was taking my husband to rounds. He was explaining things to him. You know, my husband doesn't come from a medical background, and the fact that he was there for my husband, talking to him, making sure that he was sleeping at night, making sure he was going home at the end of the day. That just gave me a lot of reassurance in his care. He would go above and beyond. There were times he would come into my room with, I'll never forget too, a printout, and I still have the printout of different meditations for me to listen to with my earbuds in. He was just treating me as a whole person. He was very aware that, wow, you know what, in order to treat her, we need to treat her anxiety. She's very anxious. We need to look at these other areas. We need to talk about her daughter and her daughter's needs and making sure that that's taken care of, because if all these other pieces aren't put together, how is this person in an ICU bed going to fully heal? And he was so aware of that.
Is this something you learned in medical school?
I think, you know, one of the great things in sort of recent years and maybe the last decade or so is that there has been certainly a shift in medical education, that we've focused a lot more on the humanistic side of what we're doing. Obviously, still the scientific, you know, aspect of it, but there's definitely a renewed or I guess a new sort of focus on the humanistic side. But, you know, I think the people who actually showed up to those lectures or didn't show up, I think it really comes from within the individual is what I'm trying to get at. Is you can have as much training as you want, but it's really what is within here, what is within, you know, your heart and soul that is going to motivate whether you would take that training in and run with it or just kind of say, okay, well, you know, I sat through that lecture, on to the next thing. And so you know, I think we certainly get the training, and for those of us who are willing and open to that, it can be really helpful. And, you know, I think that that, in my case, was very much something that I was thinking about when I was in school.
One of the things that I remember, and I don't even know if you remember this, but after I got out of rehab, I went online and I tried to find out your email address. I just typed in Dr. Jared Rosen, UCSD, and sure enough, some email address popped up and it was you. And I thought, well, I'm going to email this person. Hopefully it's him. Maybe it's not, but I'm going to email him anyway because I had things that I wanted to say to you and express my gratitude. But in that email, and I was pulling up those emails because I still have them because I collected everything because I knew I was going to write a book. But one of the things that you said in it, in that email, was much of your recovery is tied to your emotional well-being. Mm-hmm. And here, 3 years later, that stands out in my mind. And it just, it reminds me of how aware you were of not only my emotional well-being, but my entire family. You know, mm-hmm. He was on the phone with my parents. He was there, you know, helping put these pictures up on my wall with my husband, you know, making sure that I was looking at the pictures on my wall. They had somewhat of a vision board, Maddie, on my ICU room. And he would point to those pictures to remind me of my goal, of where I was heading. And just all those little pieces just gave me such reassurance in his care. I knew that when my husband was gone, that if he was there, I was safe. Mm-hmm. If something were to happen, that he was somewhere on property and he would be there and then he would notify my husband. It was just such a comforting feeling when my anxiety was at a level 10 all the time. He would come into my room and there were times that I just wanted to kick him and tell him to leave because he wanted me to do certain tasks with my body that I physically couldn't. So I wanted to tell him, like, please just get lost, or other words. But I was so grateful at the same time that he would come in. He was kind and compassionate. I knew the reason why he wanted me to do these tasks, to see if there was movement in various places of my body. So again, it was just that love, hate, like, okay, good, he's here. Thank God he is here. I'm safe. Somebody is really looking out for me. But then, like, oh, he wants me to do these things and I can't do them and I don't want to let him down. That's another thing. Mm-hmm. And when he would come into my room and he'd want me to do something, I'm like, I'm sorry. I couldn't say this because at this time I was speechless, but I just couldn't do these. And there was just a sense of heartache for not only my husband of letting him down, like, oh, I didn't make any progress overnight. I still can't do this task. And then for him too, because he was dedicating so much of his time to me and my care. And I would feel like, oh, I just let him down. He made this trip all the way into my room to see me, to see if I could do X, Y, Z. And I can't. And just that, oh, just felt like such a burden to all of them.
But Jared, I don't think you felt that way.
No, I mean, given this was the, you know, the last few weeks of medical school, getting to work with Vanessa, and, you know, I had the luxury of extra time. I didn't have mm-hmm. as many responsibilities or as many patients as I do now at the end of residency, you know, so I certainly had that luxury, but it was, I didn't view it as much of a burden. I viewed it as an opportunity mm-hmm. to work with Vanessa. And Vanessa, to your point about, you know, you feeling trapped because you were speechless and couldn't communicate a lot of these things, I promise you that your facial expressions, the dirty looks on your face when I would come in and ask you to move your arm when you were not able to, it told all of everything in the world I would need to know.
What's it like communicating with a patient who is speechless and you have these major medical events going on and you need to communicate with them? What's that like?
Well, I would say that this was a very unique experience because Vanessa is, up until that point and still since then, the only speech language pathologist who I had the pleasure of working with. I will never forget when she was awake enough to point at one of the letter boards, and she's lightning fast. Like, I'm there with Dale and we're looking over her shoulder and we're looking at each other like, what did she just say? Or what did she just try to spell out? Because she was way better and way faster than either of us were. It was almost very frustrating because I'd be like, hey, I'm sorry. Can you repeat that whole long sentence that you just spelled out? Or that you just, like, it was like a paragraph. And we're like, so I got cat. That was about all I got. And so I think that was sometimes challenging for us, and I'm sure very frustrating for her. And I remember, Vanessa, at some point you got some app where you could text out the words and it would read it aloud, sort of Stephen Hawking style. And it was a little bit easier for all of us. I think that eased a lot of the burden, but it was still really challenging because, you know, the moments where things were calm and there wasn't a lot going on, you know, that was easy. She could spell that out. And there were moments like when we attempted to extubate her, or, you know, other really challenging moments where she was not able to sit there and calmly point out words or text on her phone. And that was, you know, extremely challenging because it was only one-way communication. And we could say whatever we wanted, but she couldn't say what she wanted back. And I think that only from my perspective, at least, it seemed to only amplify, and rightfully so, just the fear and the terror and the anxiety.
Mm-hmm. That's where the trust and the time you had put in at the beginning of establishing a relationship with her for the trust and the security came in just big time, big time. But in a medical setting, people come to us at their worst, and we have to develop these relationships very quickly, very deeply.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
You know, it's something I've thought about a lot over the years. And I think especially, you know, having worked a lot during the pandemic, it's become particularly important and particularly salient. And I think you just learn how to do it. I'm not really sure. It's just sort of an organic process that you just learn to do. If you're, you know, as most of us are in medicine, you know, empathic, caring people, you know, you learn to do it. You learn to go and walk into a room and say, hey, you know, I'm Dr. So-and-so. I met your grandma 2 days ago. We need to talk about end of life for her. And you learn these skills. And I think a lot of it is really just, it's channeling you as a person. It's not about channeling. We talked earlier about sort of what training we get on this in medical school. Sure, we did these simulations, you know, with actors as patients and learning how to have hard conversations. But what it really comes down to is how much are you able to channel yourself as an individual and your humanism? And I think that with some training will carry you as far as you need to go.
How do people do that, though, for people who aren't there and who want to walk in, whether they're a medical SLP and they really want to connect, or a school SLP and they have these students that they really want to connect? How do they reach down into that core? It comes naturally for you.
You know, I think when I've had to explain this to interns or to medical students, I say, what I want you to do is I want you to imagine this is your family member, you know, so or a close friend. And I want you to think about how would you want them to be treated? What would you want them to be told? Or let's say you are the one in that bed over there. How would you want this to be explained to you? Or how would you want someone to behave towards you? And you're right. I mean, I think there's a certain degree that for certain people that comes a little bit more naturally than others. But, you know, I think even for people it's not as natural, if you really try to put yourself in the mindset of a loved one or yourself in that bed, you can start to really understand what would it that you would want to be told to you.
Thanks for giving me that pushback. I know a lot of listeners on the podcast, they see skilled people, skilled SLPs, skilled guests who come on, and they're like, I want to be like that. And they don't know how to be like that. So that perspective taking, that role playing is so important. So we can make those connections. They can make those connections.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, as just as part of training when I was in school or in residency and things that I have done to practice, you know, with the students or the interns who have worked with me, is we have done these sort of role play activities in a structured setting to kind of get a feel for it, because it is awkward at first. It feels very strange the first time you walk in a room and you say, hi, I'm your new doctor. Grandma's not doing so well in the ICU. Nice to meet you. We need to talk about, you know, possibly transitioning to a comfort focused, you know, form of care. You've never met me before. And I remember the first times doing this, you know, early in my training, I'm like, wow, this is really strange. This is really unnatural, because it is. In what other sense do we build such deep, you know, trust with an individual within minutes or hours or maybe a couple of days of meeting them? But you have to out of necessity. And so, you know, you kind of have to just do it. You have to dive in. And so you know, I've certainly done role playing in practice, and I think that certainly can help make those situations less awkward. But I mean, I remember my first times doing that where it was real time, and it's not easy. It's not perfectly natural.
I think one of the things that comes to my mind when we're talking about this topic is something that we talk heavily about in the school setting, and that's some of your nonverbal language. You know, your eyes. How are you communicating with your eyes? COVID right now makes things challenging with mask usage in the hospital setting, but I remember, and I'm so fortunate that I was in the ICU pre-COVID times, but I could see your smile. To me, that was comforting. Okay, he would come in and, you know, he would crack jokes with me and help alleviate some of that tension in the room. But some of those facial expressions and being able to approach the family member, shake hands with them, just the mere fact of Dale being able to go to rounds and stand next to you and lean on you, not so much in a physical way, but just having that connection. And again, those nonverbal body language, what you're doing with your hands, I think that sends a signal too. That's one of the things that I, with you too, that it was like, all right, you know, your eyes, he's focused on me. He's looking at me. He would give me a smile. And when I was crying, you could see in his face that he was feeling it with me. Mm-hmm. And trust me, there were a lot of tears shed during that month.
Mm-hmm. So she was your patient in your setting for a month?
Yeah, I think it was about 3 weeks that whole time, Vanessa. And it's interesting, you bring up the point about, you know, cracking jokes. And it's something that I don't even really think about because that's just kind of my personality in the hospital and outside the hospital. But I think that's another thing that it really gets to that point of, you know, when I walk into a room, you know, I'm your, you know, medical practitioner, and I'm here to explain what's going on and try to figure out what's going on and treat you. But again, like, I try to think of myself as a person. I try not to put this wall between myself and my patients. I try to eliminate that wall. It's like, again, I am another person here with you. Yes, I have, you know, a lot of training and experience, but I'm another person. And how can we just sit here and connect as people? And, you know, whether you're in the ICU or, you know, part of my residency, we work doing primary care at the VA. And I sit there and crack jokes with my patients in clinic. And I'm, you know, try to connect with them, because that's how you get people to work with you. And that's mm-hmm. how people feel comfortable telling you, you know, really tough, challenging things, is trying to break down that barrier. And I've never had anybody, you know, say, oh, well, you feel much more like a friend than my doctor. They still view me as their doctor, mm-hmm. but they view me as somebody they want to talk to mm-hmm. and they want to share things with. And I think that, like I said, it's Vanessa brings that up. It's something I don't even think about a lot of time because it's just kind of my jokes or personality. But I think it's a really key thing.
I think some of the jokes in the ICU setting, and I don't even know if you remember this, but I remember typing out on my keyboard or whatever I was using at that point, like, your jokes are horrible.
I'm sorry. Dale laughed at plenty of my dad jokes. Thank you very much.
I know. He would laugh, but I was like, this is not funny. But again, it goes back to that love-hate relationship. Like, I hated his jokes. They were so bad, but I love the fact that he was trying. He was trying to lighten the mood. He was trying to make me smile. And it just broke down, like you were saying, it broke down that wall of, I'm up here and you're down here. I'm a doctor and you're just a patient. It brought us to equal levels mm-hmm. to the point that, yeah, you are a trusted individual. Yes, you are my doctor, but I view you as an equal to my husband now. You care about me. You care about my family. You're not just my doctor. You're somebody that I truly value and support.
Mm-hmm. Because of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. I'll be honest. The first time he came into my room, I thought, oh boy, he looks like he's 12. He can't be my doctor. You know, his skin is perfect. He reminds me of like a Doogie Howser of the 80s or so. And I thought, this guy can't be my doctor. No way. And then just instantaneously, I was like, yes, that's my doctor. And I want him by my side until the minute I leave here. And then when I leave here, I want him back. And that's why when I got home, I got on my computer, I typed in his name, and I thought, I've got to find this guy. I got to thank him for for everything he did for all of us.
So personality, competence, connection, communication,
yeah,
trust.
Absolutely.
Those are some of the top things that made everything work for you. Vanessa, I've been in a hospital bed waiting for an unknown to walk in through the door. I've not been speechless like you, but I know when I am lying there, I'm wondering, you know, are they going to be good? Are they going to care? Are they going to connect? What was that like laying in the bed waiting for your physician to come in? Because he doesn't have a name or a face yet. What's that like?
Well, the first couple of days, I don't really remember anything. I remember being relieved when speech finally came in the door because I knew I couldn't talk. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking, okay, good, finally they're here. And then, you know, once weaning of the medications, I start becoming more and more aware, that's when, you know, dozens of people started entering my room. And so many different medical professionals, I don't know what they were taking samples for, what they wanted from me. They were all incredible, no doubt. Very knowledgeable, very patient, very understanding. Trying to work with a patient that, with an unknown diagnosis, they were all just as perplexed as I was. But having them come into my room and at least answer questions that my husband had or be there for them, it was very reassuring. I knew I was at a teaching facility, so I knew I was getting the best care. I knew I was at the right place. There was no doubt in my mind that being at UCSD was the place that would be able to figure this out, that would give me the right care. So in some respects, it was very, very reassuring in a very scary time. You know, my anxiety was at a level 10 the whole time. It was a very scary period. But again, you know, I know when Dr. Rosen walked in the room, my anxiety was still high, but, you know, I know it would come down a little bit because I knew that he may not have answers as to what's going on, but he was at least somebody for us to lean on. And that's just incredible.
We've called him your second husband at times.
Yep. Yes. Yep, no doubt. It was like when my husband was gone, when they would kick him out and say, you need to go home and sleep and eat and take care of yourself. I knew that, or if my husband had to step out and make phone calls, that, you know, I was afraid that there would be code blue on me or who knows what. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because my anxiety was going, it was my thoughts. And, you know, I was thinking, I know this is it for me. I, you know, let's start planning my funeral. But I knew that when my husband was gone, that my quote-unquote second husband, Dr. Rosen, was going to be somewhere around there, that I would be okay, that the machines wouldn't stop working, that if something were to go down, that I would be okay. And I had to keep telling myself that over and over again.
So, Jared, this is clearly a very impactful connection she has with you. Mm-hmm. How has working with her changed your outlook in your practice as a medical doctor?
No, I mean, and as I think I was kind of alluding to earlier, you know, this was this very sort of formative time, you know, the last few weeks of medical school right before I was about to start my residency. And so it was an opportunity for me to kind of work and explore, you know, what was the right style for me? What was important to me? What were the kind of values and important thing, you know, the values that I had and what was I going to place importance on? And, you know, having those really solid, very positive experiences working with Vanessa, it gave me an opportunity to see, wow, this is what the true power of being this way can, what can that do for my patients? You know, being able to just, you know, show my true compassion, not have to hide it, to just entirely be myself, you know, in terms of from a personal standpoint as well as a professional standpoint, and to really let that shine through and to see the impact that had. And I think, you know, had Vanessa not contacted me after, I think I still would have known, but I think particularly because she tracked me down, you know, some months later, and you know, we've now been able to talk many times since. It has sort of further reinforced that, you know, who I was able to explore being back then is the kind of doctor that I wanted to become going forward. It has definitely influenced my practice, particularly, you know, Vanessa brought up earlier the challenges of now during COVID, you can't see people's faces or people can't be in the hospital. One of the probably more profound moments that sticks out of my mind during the pandemic is I worked in the ICU probably about 15 weeks in the second half of 2021. And I remember one of those weeks, we had a very sick patient. It was a US citizen who was vacationing down in Mexico and was airlifted back on a ventilator to UCSD in the middle of the night. And, you know, he, when we were taking care of him in the ICU, I got a call from the nurse saying, hey, his wife and mother were airlifted with them. They're not sick, but they're not allowed to come to the hospital. They're outside the hospital. And it's like 1 o'clock in the morning right now. And I'm like, okay, all right, well, let me kind of get their loved ones settled in, get the ventilators set up, you know, with the rest of the team. And, you know, they want, because they're sick. She said she wanted an update. I said, okay, give me a little bit of time. And I go, we finish up. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. I told them, try to get them a hotel, but I'm going to come down and talk to them. And it was this eeriest thing, right? You know, put on all my PPE, the N95, the face shield, the gown, everything. And I walked outside the front of the hospital in the middle of the night because that's where his family was. And I'm sitting there talking, you know, kind of yelling to them from 6-10 feet away, just trying to tell them, you know, what was going on with their family member, you know, what was the situation, and providing updates. And it was just this weird, really eerie kind of situation of, wow, have we really gotten to this point where I'm standing outside all geared up in the middle of the night talking to some family member? But it was really important to me to actually go out in person. You know, we could have picked up the phone and called them on their cell phone, but I'm like, no, they're here. Let me show them the respect and compassion that they deserve. I'm taking care of their family member here. And it was just that moment, you know, out of many of the moments from COVID really has stuck with me. And I've reflected on that as I've talked to Vanessa a bunch that, you know, it is those small little things, you know, that can make a huge difference for that family. And I certainly hope that little extra step meant something extra to them and showed them in some small way the degree of compassion and care that their loved one is going to receive in the hospital.
You said something interesting. You said, I was able to be me. I was able to. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is one of the keys of connecting on a genuine, authentic level with those we work with. Mm-hmm. Whatever setting it is, be you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Final question for each of you. What words of advice do you have for the speech pathologist who is listening to this regarding physician-patient relationships? How do you make that? I know we've talked a lot about that connection, that trust, that security. Final words of advice for making that connection, especially for someone who's speechless.
Well, I can speak from my own experience watching through the window one of the first times that Vanessa had the opportunity to meet one of the speech pathologists. And I remember watching through the window of the ICU, and the speech pathologist is holding Vanessa's hand. And I remember looking through, and they're just both crying. Mm-hmm. There was this, you know, connection. You have two speech pathologists, you know, sort of this mirror image, one standing there, you know, in her scrubs and the other one in a hospital gown. And I think that very easily those roles could have been reversed. And I think it's important for all of us, whether you're a speech pathologist or a doctor or a nurse, to remember that that could easily be swapped. Right. You could very easily be in that bed. And how would you want that person to behave towards you? How would you want to be treated? You know, I know this kind of sounds trite, the old, you know, golden rule, treat others how you would want to be treated sort of thing. But I think that that really rings true. And it's hard for us at times. You know, I think particularly in the hospital setting, you know, it can be a tough grind. There's a lot of burnout. There's a lot that's going on, especially during the pandemic. But it's important to sort of circle back to that core tenet of you could very easily be in that bed instead. And Vanessa's story, you know, I think is a perfect reflection of, you know, we're not talking, she's some 85-year-old grandma in the bed. She was a, you know, young person who was fine one day and not the next.
Vibrant.
It's important for us to remember that.
Yeah.
I think for me, it's to treat that person as if that was your wife, your mom, your dad, you know, your brother. Before I went into various procedures, I remember asking at all levels of care that I was at, would you recommend the same treatment to your wife? If I was your wife, would you tell me to do the same thing? Whether it was, you know, being intubated, whatever it was. If I was your wife, would you want me to do this? And a lot of the professionals would look at me and they would freeze for a minute, think about it, and then they would come back. And every time they came back, they said, yes, I would tell my wife. If you were my wife, I would tell you to do XYZ procedure. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to do it. Because I had more faith in their recommendation, because if they would recommend this to their own mother or their own wife, then this is probably what I need. And that gave me a lot of respect for them. So I think just treating that person and that family as if it was your own family that you're delivering bad news to or good news to. If you have to talk to them about a brain scan or a upcoming medical procedure that's very scary, talk to them like you're sitting down with your wife and, you know, hold their hand through it and, you know, resonate with them and try to understand that this is terribly scary. This family's life has just been flipped upside down. They were, you know, for me, I was just this working mom, busy as can be, and within a week's time, everything was flipped upside down. So try as best as you can to put yourself in their shoes.
Excellent. Well, as we wrap up this episode, I want to say thanks to each of you, Dr. Rosen, particularly for setting such a good example for all of us on how to be human and connect and show care and compassion. And Vanessa, you just, each time you come on, you open up as the Speechless SLP and you share and you make the world a better place. So thank you both of you and for your service as well. Thank you very much for coming on the Missing Link for SLPs podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, hey, SLPs, that concludes this episode of the Missing Link for SLPs podcast. Please visit my website at freshslp.com, follow me on Instagram, or jump on Facebook to connect in our safe and friendly Fresh SLP community, where we are empowering new and transitioning SLPs. If you found value in this episode, or in any way had an aha moment, or I gave you a fresh perspective, please show me some SLP love and support me on iTunes or the Apple Podcast app, or subscribe to me on YouTube. You got this.